You're listening to the NASM CPT Podcast with Rick Ritchie, the official podcast of the National Academy of Sports Medicine.
Welcome to the NASM CPT Podcast. My name is Rick Ritchie. Thank you so much for being here today. I don't have a guest today on the podcast. And one of the things that we've been asked about were, what can you answer some questions for us? And the answer is, yeah, of course we can answer some questions for you. So I'd love to take some questions from the audience today. So for those of you who are tuning in on a Facebook Live, then please, if you've got questions about NASM, about training, what are some of those questions that you have? I may or may not have the answer. I don't know, but I can probably provide some type of insight, some educated, some content. And if I can't, I'll let you know I can't, because I'm not just going to make something up. And that leads me to something else. I was on Instagram. I was on the old Instagram, and I was scrolling through, and there was a sponsored post that came up, and it was some Dr. So-and-so who said, weight training doesn't work. And I was like, oh my goodness, here's somebody using their title as a means to speak untruths to sell something else. And so this person was selling something about elastic training, elastic bands, and that's great. I think that that's good. Elastic bands do a wonderful job. They can help with increasing strength. They can help you increase hypertrophy. They can help with your endurance. They can help you with stabilization training. It's all wonderful. But to say one doesn't work so that you can sell a book or a video series on something else is a fallacy. And so that's one of the, I believe it's Aristotle's logical fallacies, is the appeal to authority. So when you're arguing with somebody and you go, yes, but Dr. So-and-so says this, Dr. Rick says this, you have to be careful with that. And because there are a lot of people out there that use a title and use their education to make claims that are unsubstantiated. And therefore, when I say something, and I'm not quoting that directly from the research, the one thing about my education is that it's exposed me to a lot of research and a lot of content. So I'm not smarter than anyone. I tell my wife all the time, I was like, I'm not smart, I'm just educated. And everybody listening to this podcast, I guarantee, smarter than I am. The education is something that I desired. It's something that I wanted, I went after. And so I got exposed to a lot of information. One of the reasons I like to think, at least, that I'm a good teacher is because I have a hard time breaking down, understanding concepts. So my ability really comes from, can I make this palatable and something that I can understand? And then I take it and I deliver it, hopefully in a way that you can understand too. And that's really the value of what comes out of it. But I don't really want anybody to go, well, Rick says this, and appeal to the authority there, because what I'd like for you to do is to be a learner and somebody that comes to listen to the podcast, but goes and studies. And then, you know, Google Scholar is such a great thing that everyone has access to. The National Institutes of Health as something that everybody now that has the internet and computer has access to, that you can look up content. Careful about another logical fallacy, which is cherry picking, and that's finding only the things that work to answer the question that you have. And you can read a study and you go, that one doesn't agree with me, so I'm going to keep looking through until I find something that does agree with me. So that's why things like meta-analysis are so important. So I did pull up a meta-analysis on variable resistance training and using elastic bands. So variable resistance training is just when the weight changes or the resistance changes. So using bands, so as you start pulling, they're not as intense. And as you get further into your range of motion, the bands get heavier and harder to pull. Same thing with chains. Chains are variable resistance training. Same thing with suspension training. Usually as you pull, like think about doing a row on a suspension training device like a TRX, right? And you're rowing and it gets easier as you pull yourself up at certain angles. So here's something that I pulled up, it was a wonderful, wonderful article that, and just pull up who the authors were. It says the effects of training with resistance vary versus conventional resistance training on muscular strength. And it's a systematic review and it's a meta-analysis. And those two things are very important things when it comes to research, because it takes the idea and the concept of whatever you're researching, because research is really myopic. Right? Research says, I want to take this population of this age and this group in this sport or this category, and we're going to look at this outcome. And so it's really myopic. So what a meta-analysis does is it takes the myopic study of that and another one like that and another one like that, that's all studying, let's say, ACL reconditioning or repair or therapeutics in order to get back to play for 15 to 18 year old female soccer players. All right, that's pretty limited. But then you get another group of male soccer players, and you get another group, and you get another group, and then different sports. And then now we have a meta-analysis that gives us a lot of information. And one of the things that came out of this by Sylvia Lopez et al., and et al. Just means everybody else that contributed to the study, did a big meta-analysis on this. And this was published in 2019. And it really says that variable resistance training is fantastic and comparable in many, many ways to free weight training or other types of resistance training. So that's fantastic. I'll tell you something that I like to do. This is a personal thing that I like to do, is think about doing a row with resistance band. So I'm going to row, and as I pull farther into that row with the band, it gets more and more difficult as I get to my end range of motion. Well, you might flip that over into looking at things like the suspension training. So the TRX and the Jungle Gym and the Rip Trainer and all of these different other tools. And I do a row, and it might be harder at the beginning and easier as I go through it. So one of the things that I like to do is I might put together a toll program for clients with bands and suspension trainers. And so I'm working them harder at the beginning range of motion with a suspension trainer, and I'm working them harder at the end range of motion with the resistance band. And I think that that's a pretty well done, well thought out consideration for resistance training. Here's another thing that's super valuable about this conversation. So many people are stuck at home right now. A lot of gyms, some are open, some are closed. Some people don't feel comfortable yet coming to the gyms because of the pandemic. So you get access to a suspension trainer, which people can hang in their door. They get access to the bands, which people oftentimes can loop into their door and use that as something to anchor it. And then you put together a really good program for your Zoom training, for your Skype training, your FaceTime training. Your virtual training now has been armed with something that's not that expensive for your clients, and something that they can all kind of post against a door in order to be able to utilize it. I think it's a pretty quality idea, something that you may want to consider. So one of the things that came up that I wanted to address was definitely about that. Let's talk about some other things that have come up. One of the questions that came up was about what I'm teaching at Optima. And so thank you for asking that. I'm going to be doing one on balance training, because balance is in every phase of the OPT model. And a lot of times people skip over balance training. So we're going to talk about balance training and practice it. A lot of people with certain types of courses, when you plan it out before it goes all virtual, there's a lot of times people switch things from a workshop to a lecture. Not this guy. All right. Not on this particular one. I wanted the balance to have, let's talk about it a little bit, but then let's also practice it. So you sign up for that course in Optima, you're going to be standing on one leg, and you will be multiple times during our time together. So a little less than an hour, we'll be stomping your foot on the ground, trying to put out the fire. You're going to feel the bottom of your feet working. You're going to feel your hips working. So the balance programming, I think, is really a quality thing, and it needs to be applied in every single level and every phase of the OPT model. So this kind of gives you a breakdown on how it's done and shows you how challenging it can be when it's done correctly and when it's programmed within the model and the way it's set up. The next one I'm going to be doing is high intensity interval training. So a HIIT workout, body weight, bands, and towels. This is kind of more of a how-to, a little educational thing. So the body weight stuff I didn't really get into. So we talked a little bit more about bands and what to do with bands, but then I spend the majority of the time doing workouts with towels. And I love doing training with towels, and I will treat towels as if they are ropes and you're doing these battling ropes. And you can take that kind of concept and plug in a towel instead of a rope and do something very similar. And it's wildly challenging. And some people look at it and they're like, that is absurd. Well, it does kind of look absurd, but I guess so does wiggling around a bunch of ropes. But because it's a rope and because you see a lot of athletes do it, you go, oh, super cool, I want to try. It's the same thing, same concept, except you have less resistance and you have more speed. And you also have to be careful so that you don't smack yourself with a towel, which it only kind of hurts, but it hurts. And then something also that I'm going to be talking about, valuable, I think you should, if you've worked in the fitness industry at some point, you've probably thought about opening your own gym. So I'm going to be doing a live Optima podcast. So it'll be the NASM CPT podcast on how to open your own gym. Challenges at this point certainly exist. It may not be the smoothest carryover on this is how you do it during or fresh off the heels of peak pandemic season, but it will give you a lot of quality information on what to do and how to do it. So if it's something that you're looking into and that's something you want to consider, then think about how you can open your own gym. And I'm going to provide some information that I found really valuable in opening my facilities in New York City, and maybe it's something that you can apply where you are currently. So there's a list of a few things that several people had asked me about, but I want to jump over because Greg, our producer, is on the thread with people. And so, hey, Greg, what's up, man?
Morning. I've seen the towel workout in person at Optima, and yes, it does look ridiculous, and it is very difficult. It actually gets you sweating, gets you moving. So you are not lying there.
You get a whole group of people with basically fanning towels. It looks really funny to have a lot of people do it, but they were all fitness pros, and they were all gassed from doing it. So it's fun to watch it, and it's fun to do it. My clients actually really enjoy doing the towel training. And every once in a while, I get somebody that'll say, hey, we haven't done the towel thing in a while. When do we get to do that again? So that's pretty cool.
And you can do it basically anywhere because there's usually a towel readily available.
That's it. Exactly. It's like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for fitness. You can always use a towel.
We recommend clean, though. It's not as fun when it's a dirty towel. So, Rick, would you like some questions from the audience?
I would. Any popped up?
Oh, there have been a lot that have popped up, and we're going to test my reading skills this morning. So, which muscle is underactive, lengthened, allowing scapular elevation during a pulling assessment? Is it serratus anterior or the lower trapezius?
All right. Which muscle is underactive, which are lengthened, allowing the scapular elevation during a pulling assessment? So let's say, let me get that hair down. All right. So when you look at a pulling assessment and you start to see people shrug up, so what's going to be overactive and what's going to be underactive? Well, I've got this kind of shrugging position here. So I'm shrugging my shoulders up as I row. One thing to consider is that there may not be an overactive, underactive issue. There may be a cueing issue. Not all of our clients know what things are supposed to look like. So the first thing is to cue what's going on and to get your clients to understand what it is that you want from them. So doing elevation, rowing back so far that the retraction disappears in a row, so that you can get your hands even farther back. Because sometimes your clients think, this must be what you want. You wanted me to pull this to me, so I'm going to pull it back as far as I can. And as you probably have experienced, when you pull your hands in a row position as far back as you can, you lose a lot of retraction. You get spinning of the humeral head inside the socket, and then you get a scapular elevation that takes place and allows you to pull back farther. So first things first, let's cue. Probably not the answer you were looking for. So now let's discuss what's going on here. Is some of the lengthened, some of the overactive muscles, if there is an overactive muscle in this situation, would be the upper traps. And think about like the levator scapula, which is also going to be an elevator of the scapula. And I love this because we get into some of the functional anatomy of what's going on during an exercise. So your upper traps can retract in addition to elevate. So that may be a culprit in an exercise where the retraction gets kind of overtaken by an elevation. It says I can do two things, but one thing I can do really maybe better than the other one. So as it shortens, you get this shrugging position that takes place. Also watch the head position. As people start to shrug their shoulders, they tend to nutate their head back into extension. So keep a neutral position there. What might be underactive? Or during this position, particularly lengthened, and that would be the lower traps. I like that the suggestion was potentially serratus anterior, which is a possibility, and there are some potentials for the serratus anterior to actually be a depressor of the scapula, but it doesn't work great in depression. So, or as a depressor. So I would say more lower traps as a component of that. Also, be aware that anytime you get you start to go into a retraction and then you go into elevation, the scapula can elevate and then anteriorly tip forward. So the pec minor might have a component to do with that. It's a protractor, so it may not like retraction very much. And that way, if you do some foam rolling on the pec minor, maybe do some release on the upper trap and levator scapula, and then do some activations for lower traps and mid traps. Lower traps because it retracts and depresses, mid traps because it retracts. Then maybe then we'll start to get this pull into retraction and mitigate some of the elevation that's taking place. As we start to feel more comfortable doing retraction, then we don't feel, or your muscles don't feel like they need to cheat into elevation. So I hope that answers your question. And again, anything you've got with functional anatomy, I'm totally interested in. I can probably answer those questions when it comes to general exercise. So just shooting from the hip, but it's a relatively solid answer. It was just a bit loquacious, so I apologize.
There's no problem. No need to apologize on that. Mary wants to know, for strength training and building muscle, how many days do you recommend for best results so that cardio does not eat away, for lack of a better term, at muscle a person is trying to build?
All right. So Mary, this is a really good question. Strength training, building muscle, it's important. And you get a lot of people who are doing competitions that will try to both build muscle, but then they have to start losing body fat. And so they'll add cardio into it. Here's the bottom line with that. You can do cardio and you should do cardio. Cardiorespiratory health is important. And if you're not doing resistance training, so for instance, if you're doing hypertrophy training, your resistance training is likely not one of those types of training that's going to spike your metabolic rate greatly. So you probably lift, break, lift, break, lift, break, which is good for hypertrophy training. Here's the thing. It is possible to build muscle and to lose body fat at the same time. It is just challenging. And one of the things that needs to be considered with this is how much protein you get in so that you are not cannibalizing your muscle for the sake of your cardio. And that happens probably a little bit less than people think it happens, but however, it does still happen. And if we're going to build muscle and we're going to create an anabolic effect, then we need to make sure that there's plenty of protein coming into our bodies while we're doing it, and then still getting the cardio in is totally fine. You can do it. How many times a week? Look, it depends, which is what every trainer hates to hear, the words "it depends," but it does depend on how trained you are and what your goals are. So I would say if you're deep into training and you're doing lifts 5 times a week, that's fine, but your active recovery should be considered as opposed to a very passive recovery, which is just completely resting. Then get your active recovery in, get your cardio in. You can also limit how much you lift on some days so that you can get your moderate intensity, continuous training, your cardio in that way. So the options are still there. But one thing, if you're looking to hypertrophy and you're still looking to lose weight, that you can't skimp on, which it's got to be how much food or how many calories you're taking in, so that your protein is still staying elevated, but you might have fewer calories, or you might be metabolizing more calories and be at a caloric deficit, and that deficit actually pulling from things that aren't your muscle because you've spiked your protein and you're still in this anabolic state when you get in the good enough rest. Anytime you do a workout, you kind of dip, right? You get into this catabolic state, and you've heard anabolic steroids. And so catabolism and anabolism are two things that exist regardless of steroids, but it's when you break down and then you start to build back up after you break it down. That's anabolic, and that can be something that can be supported through actually doing things like a pretty light to moderate intensity cardio. About how do you keep from losing the muscle, keep the protein up, and that should be helpful. What is it's a typical protein is you're looking at, the old school recommendations for bodybuilding was you take in 1 gram of protein for every pound that you weigh. And that's actually seems to be relatively on par and true based off of what the studies have shown over the last few years, is that protein intake is highly indicated, and it helps to satiate, it helps to build muscle, and you should have a lot more of it if you're trying to build muscle, especially if you're adding cardio into it. So I hope you found that helpful.
So Julie wants to know, what is the best post-workout recovery item?
Best post-workout recovery item, downtown Julie Brown. Let's see, what's the best post-workout recovery item? If item means something that's not a meal, then I don't know. I think that there's so many cool things out there, Julie. There are so many cool things, from the foam rollers that vibrate to the handheld percussion tools to the pneumatic air compression sleeves that go on to the infrared sauna and infrared light and red light therapy and all of these wonderful, wonderful things that are out there now. What's the best one? I have no idea. If you could pick one item, I don't know. I don't think I could limit it to that. There's so many great things that are being utilized within our recovery today. And for somebody who owns a recovery business that supports companies with recovery experiences, then I've been exposed to a lot of things, and we have multiple modalities at Recover. I would say, you know what, if we're talking about items, I don't know. If we're talking about things that are not items, I would say your post-workout meal is highly indicated, and the amount of sleep you get is highly indicated. So exercise, diet, and sleep are probably the most important things to our life when it comes to longevity. So, not just longevity, our activities of daily living and our quality of life, those things are going to be paramount. But then you get kind of the icing on the cake with all of these other wonderful tools that are out there. If I could pick one, I would say, I know what you're waiting. thing that trainers hate to hear. It depends. So it really depends on what you're looking for. It depends on what you like. It depends on what your experiences are and what you want to take away. So Julie, I wish I could be more clear with that answer, but there's so many great things out there. I can't limit that to one item.
Oh, well then let's go to the other end of the spectrum. What is your favorite pre-workout item? What is the best pre-workout item?
Pre-workout. I know some people are out there going, say pre-workout, NO, like let's get some nitrous oxide going on and we get amped up. That's not my thing. I'm always good for a cup of coffee. That caffeine has shown to be a wonderful ergogenic aid to help people in their workouts. And who am I to look adversely at the research on coffee? So I'm a big fan of having some caffeine in the system if you want to have something that's going to help maximize your workout a little bit. That's something. Another thing too that you can put into your workouts is going to be creatine, and creatine phosphate is definitely something that throughout the years have been studied, and it's definitely shown that it can help you get, if you're pushing to the end, you're trying to get that last rep every time, then supplementing pre-workout with creatine phosphate has shown that you can kind of push through for a couple extra reps, and it keeps that, and this goes back to the energy systems, right? There's ATP, CP, there's creatine phosphate system. And if you're going all out pushing really hard and we can supplement with creatine phosphate, then you can get a few more reps out or you might be able to last a little bit longer on your pushes. So those are two things I think are indicated.
All right. Well, what are your thoughts on 3 to 30 day fasts?
I'm stunned. My thoughts on 1 30-day fast is not good. So if you've got something going on for religious reasons and you're doing a 30-day fast, then that's between you and your faith. When it comes to our overall health, I would not look at any 30-day fast as something that's going to be particularly healthy for majority of people out there. I don't know if that's what that question is. I don't know if 3 30-day fast is like a style or a concept. Maybe there's some clarity that can go on with that question, but any 30-day fast, I'm going to say is probably not going to be great. I will say that from time to time, if you want to do a 3-day fast or a 1-day fast, or there's some indications that fasting can be good for you. A 3-day fast is the longest I've ever done. And I it was good for me, but it was really for me about discipline. And also I'm a type 2 diabetic. And so I did it for me to try it. And I'd done single day fast and I'd done a 2-day fast, but to break me of having some foods that I was gravitating towards, like cereals or sandwiches, which are my favorite pre-diabetic food, but as a diabetic, it's probably not something I should be having. And I tell you what, it kind of broke that for me. A 3-day fast is not a jump into it right there. My suggestion, if you're going to start fasting, is consult a physician if you have any risk factors or contraindications. And then I would follow that up with discussing this with somebody who, a registered dietitian that you can work with that can guide you through what that looks like. And I would say then start with time-restricted feeding before going into a 24-hour fast or anything else beyond that. But, you know, there's fasting, I think, has its benefits. And some people will talk about autophagy and things like that. And listen, I think there are other ways to get autophagy. And one of them is through exercise. So my preference would be to get your autophagy through exercise, not through starving yourself. Or fasting. I think starving yourself is not the right thing when we talk about fasting. They're two different things. But there are other means at which to do it. Now, one of the things that I found helpful for me is that It did help to increase my insulin sensitivity. So from time to time, as a type 2 diabetic, I will still fast in order to get a little more sensitivity. Well, guess what else helps with insulin sensitivity? You got it. Exercise. So also adding regular exercise into your daily is highly indicated for a lot of the reasons that that seem to be the buzzwords for why people should do fasting. So there's my input on that one. All right, great.
Duly hop back in here. Can you recommend the best bands and resistance training items, going back to what you were talking about a little earlier in the show?
I can't recommend the best ones, but I will say that my preference is that you have a full set of blue ones. I'm just kidding. That's a full set of the ones with handles that you can anchor on a door. So the ones with handles, it's basically two different bands that have a converging anchor point and that also recommend any of the bands that have the little nylon cover over it. And I'll tell you why. The nylon cover is a protection from a snapping band. And I had gone somewhere recently and I brought one of those. And then before I left, I was like, let me grab a second one just in case. And then I've never had one snap on me ever. And then I went into to do a course and I had one. The very first time I did to practice it, the one I was going to use, the one I always use, snapped. And so fortunately I had a backup, but more fortunately is that I had it, it was encased in that nylon wrap, so that when the band snapped, I was not the recipient of any badness of that. So you want, they are more expensive. Get them for your safety and the safety of your clients. Get the ones that have the wrap around it. So if they snap, nobody gets hurt. I've read horror stories. I've read articles about safety. It's really something that as a gym owner, those are the only ones I have, because if it snaps, then I could be liable if anybody gets hurt. So I want to make sure that I have those. If you're working with clients, I suggest those as well. So they've got the converging anchor points that you might be able to wrap around a handle on the side of the door, on the backside, pull it through, close the door. Those are great. I also think that you should have a series of mini loops. And those mini loops that you can put around your knees, or you can do shoulder exercises, those are fantastic. They are fantastic. They are used for so many things and activations, especially around the hips that we utilize them for. Then I go with the handles, go with the converging anchor points, and then have a set of those, and then have a set of mini loops.
Great. Samantha wants to know, for a new trainer, are there any resources you can recommend for better understanding programming?
Yeah, Samantha, that's a good question. And one of the things that NASM, we are trying to get better at is to help people better understand programming. And here's what happened. We've been using the OPT model for a very long time, but sometimes it's difficult for people to implement that. So there's nobody policing you saying you have to use the OPT model. And what we also found is that we can provide a pretty good layout for people with the OPT model as far as programming. And sometimes reading that in a book simply is not enough. So at one point, it was either late 2019 or early 2020, I did a three-part series on the podcast on exercise programming. And so if you've got questions about it, and looking at that stuff in the book doesn't necessarily make it simpler, because some people like me, I have a hard time. It's just not my best way to learn. Having somebody talk about it and talk through it. So I'm going to direct your attention, at least for now, to in the short term, to the NASM CPT podcast, and to be able to check out those three particular episodes that I think you might find really helpful. And we talk about programming, we talk about the model, we talk about mesocycles, macrocycles, microcycles. We kind of go through some programming, and I think they're helpful. But the other thing too is, something that I also talk about Optima is a session on mentorship. And I think it's really valuable that if you want to learn more, then find a mentor that can help you. Find somebody that you can pay money to, that you can say, here, teach me. And you don't have to go back to school over and over again. If you can be the apprentice to some mentor out there that's doing it well, that's doing it right, that's getting results, that's tracking it well, that's supporting their clients, and you can get a piece of that by working with them, then I suggest that you do it. I think finding a mentor and working with an individual on anything, so whether that's programming or outreach or client retention and things like that, is just finding somebody who's got a solid credential and experience on the business of doing what they do in their craft and their art, and that is fitness and training, and programming is a big part of that. How else do we go about it? I can direct you back to the textbook, can direct you to the podcast, but if there's a mentor that you're looking for, then hit me up on Instagram, dr.rickritchie, and just send me a message and we can talk about it and about mentorship.
As the producer of the NASM CPT podcast, you just warmed my heart by promoting the show while on the show.
So thank you.
Londi wants to know, do you recommend a person who has back problems do suspension elastic exercises such as a TRX?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the answer, as usual, it depends. And it depends on what the back problem is. And sometimes suspension training exercises like rows, you can control the intensity of that exercise. So just because you have back problems doesn't mean that your back should never stabilize you in an erect position in your spine. So to go and do a suspension training exercise could be really good for your back. As a matter of fact, think about things like bridges. Bridges for people with back problems can oftentimes be really helpful. Well, it's still, you have to keep your spine straight. So that can be putting tension or resistance against your spine. Your spine in that exercise, if you didn't have your erectors there, would flex. Well, your erectors keep your spine straight. Same thing with suspension training. Your erectors keep your spine straight. You can control it. Here's the thing. If it hurts, don't do it. Don't do it. That's the old joke when a person goes to their doctor and they say, doctor, it hurts when I do this. And the doctor goes, well, don't do that. I think there's just a simplicity and a value in knowing that sometimes we put things and we say, oh, you're not supposed to do that. Because you can do suspension training in a very non-challenging environment, you can work your way up to the challenge, maybe get some good resistance training and find out that it really doesn't have anything to adversely affect how you feel in your spine. That's with stabilization. I would say that if you're going through ranges of motion, like flexion, extension, or hyperextension, rotations, then to start slow, start light, and you can still create a challenge with that. But doing things in stabilization first, like a body weight row with a suspension trainer, is going to be probably a much safer position than doing other core exercises where you're actually going through ranges of motion, flexion, extension, lateral flexion, rotation in your spine. So stabilize first and then see if you can start adding things into it. But I think it's a great exercise.
All right. No question from this next person, but as a producer, I've learned you've got to keep your talent happy. So I want to get this in here. It says, hey, Rick, I have my exam in a week and I've been watching the cueing videos. You do a great job explaining. You have great energy. So thank you.
The Goldman. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. Those cueing videos are a lot of fun, actually. So when I went through those videos, it's interesting because I might have something in mind and then I might miss something or not see something else because I'm focusing on a few other things, but I do think that queuing is one of those arts that, you know, when people say, what's the best queue to get somebody to do something? I think there's some really well done established queues. But as you know, the best queue is the one that works. And you might provide a queue to somebody and then they not get it. And you provide one of your other old faithful queues and they don't get it. And we like to point a finger at our clients and be like, oh, they are so this and that. They just don't get anything. Those people, it isn't their fault. It's not their fault. It's our fault. It's our fault as a trainer when we can't get somebody to do something because we haven't yet learned how they receive communication best, how they best receive it. So, and there's no blame necessarily to be put out there, but also know that it's not their fault. And if we put the fault on us, then that puts it on us to find a solution, which may not be done in the first session or the first 10 sessions. But as you learn more about your client and how they receive information, it makes it easier for us then to promote to them the best way to communicate and the best way to get those outcomes. So there are good cues. There are cues that are old faithful. And thank you so much for talking about that. And the queuing videos, I'm really proud of because I do think that it's something that needs to be addressed more within the fitness industry. Not just that, I also think that spotting needs to be addressed more because that's a safety issue. And there's very little communication out there on what is a good way, appropriate way, best practice for how you spot people in certain exercises. Might be another topic for another day for a podcast, even though I would really like that to be in video form simply because seeing how to spot is a lot different than hearing somebody talk about it and then try to figure out what exactly it is they're talking about. But listen, man, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it and I appreciate that feedback.
Morgan wants to know, what are some good core exercises for someone who struggles to engage their core, even in plank?
Okay, Morgan, thanks. That's a good question. And the first thing I want to say is that plank is a progressed exercise for the core. So many people jump to that as like a level one basic exercise. And it is like our OPT model says, well, what are good exercises in stabilization level for the core? And it is any exercise where you're really, there's little to no movement of the core. But if you can't engage in a plank exercise and then you get people doing it and they feel it in their back, stop doing that exercise or at least stop doing it that way. I'll give you a for instance. And my wife was having back problems. And so I sent her to my friend, Pete, who's a physical therapist. And I'll forego, like, I'm not a physical therapist, so I send to him and I can help in certain ways, but it's also my wife, so she doesn't really listen to me. So I send her to Pete, and Pete gave her some exercises to do. And, you know, these are kind of like take-home exercises. And I asked her if she'd been doing her exercises. She said, no, they hurt my back. And I said, what hurts your back? And she said, a plank. And she said, I kept trying to do it, even though it hurt my back. And then I stopped. And I was like, any exercise you do that hurts your back when you have back problems is an exercise you should stop doing immediately. So what are some good core exercises if a plank is too progressed of an exercise? One is just a simple regression of a plank. And one of the things you can do is just, I like having full body planks. You can do a plank from your knees on the ground and be on your forearms. You can make it a little bit easier. You can do a full plank in a push-up position. That would be a nice way to do it. You could do it from your knees with your arms out straight. That is even more regressed. I like having people in that push-up plank position, hands on a bench or hands on a massage table that's a little bit higher. You can use bars like a squatting bar and change the height, and you can do that. I'm going to tell you probably my favorite engagement exercise for the core. And when you first do it with your clients, they look at it and they think it's a chest exercise. So have somebody lie back on their back. And I have them do a posterior tilt. And so they're pushing their low back into the ground, sucking in their belly button, and then take their, let's say take your left hand, put it just below your belly button. So your thumb is right in your belly button and your other, the rest of your hand is just below the belly button to keep that drawn in. And then take a dumbbell, a light dumbbell. And as they're lying on their back with their feet relatively narrow, have them do a single arm fly with their right hand. Now, it looks like a pec exercise, but the weight's so light, it's probably not going to affect their chest really that much at all. But it's that movement, that leverage, as the dumbbell moves farther away from the center of gravity, your body is naturally going to want to go with it. But your core is tightening and you feel the core tightening and engaging. The other thing about core stabilization exercises is they should not feel like crunches. The exercises you do for core stabilization should not feel the same way that doing a crunch or a sit-up or some of the more challenging exercises are. It should simply feel like it's activating. And as you go through these activations, you can challenge it harder and harder. I like doing that single arm fly, do a set of 15 on one side, switch it over, do the same thing, add some weight if you need to. You can have them do it in a bridged position. You can have them do it with a long foam roller going from the base of the head all the way down to the sacrum, supporting their back on that, getting a range of motion and trying to stabilize on top of a foam roller, a half foam roller, or a TerraCore. Those are all wonderful options. You can do the same thing with, like they're called Palloff presses, where you take a cable and it's coming directly from the side. And as you push out in front of you, holding that weight, you can do repetitions, push out, pull back in, push out, pull back in. They're all just core stabilization exercises. I think there are wonderful core stabilization exercises out there. You can do that single arm fly thing where in a bridged position too, which I like to do because it can challenge the glutes and the hips a little bit more while still doing things for the core above the hips. So it's, there are a lot of options out there, but the options that you should not take are the ones that don't stimulate activity or the ones that that hurt or feel in places that aren't where you're trying to find that. So I hope that's helpful. And if we have any more questions, I'm happy to take one more and then start to close this bad boy up.
Yeah, we have one more. April says that she's struggling in terms of taking the exam and is wondering, is it as difficult as some people say it is when it comes to the NASM CPT exam?
Yeah, it is awful. I'm just kidding. Man, here's another one. Ready? It depends. And that, again, not the answer that anybody wants to hear, but, you know, the studying is challenging and the content can be challenging and new information can be challenging. I think one of the things that are most helpful is trying to apply it to yourself so that you can apply workouts and concepts. So when you do things, you can be like, oh, if I do that, then this is called reciprocal inhibition. And this particular stretch, when I'm doing my static stretch and as you're doing it, you go, this is autogenic inhibition that's taking place at this muscle. But when I do it actively, then I'm adding reciprocal inhibition to, okay, great. Length tension relationship or in the stabilization phase and I'm practicing that, then I know here are my core balance and reactive or plyometric workouts. Here's my speed, agility, and quickness. And then here's my resistance training. And here's my rep range. Here's my set range and the intensity. And how can I apply that to me? And once you make those applications, it can be simpler. But there are a lot of things out there that it's not like how difficult or how simple is it? So one of the things that you can do is you can practice those. There's a practice exam. And though the practice exam is not the exam, so don't think that the answers and the questions that are on the exam are the ones that are going to be on the test. That's not necessarily the case. But what it does is gives you an idea of what it's going to be like. Quizzes at the end of chapters when you do the online course and the training, those are really helpful. The practice quiz is really, really helpful. And here's the other thing. Worst case scenario, you go and you take the exam, and it was not what you had studied. It is not how you had studied. It's not the concepts that you had spent most of your time on, and you don't pass. That's okay. That's okay. And what we do sometimes, we beat ourselves up on it, and we can't do that. Just know that now you've got the experience of what the test does look like. You are given a list of things that maybe you missed more questions on this than anything else. You go back to those things and study those particular ones. And I think that's really helpful. And it's also helpful to know that you have the opportunity to take the exam again. So don't feel like this is a one and done deal, and don't beat yourself up about it. Know that you're going into it. Yes, it is going to be challenging. The studying process is challenging, but you will do well eventually. And I'm assuming if you're the person that's asking that kind of question, you're studying and you're going to do great the first time through. So good luck with your test, by the way.
One other thing I'd recommend is the NASM Edge app. There's the study prep portion of that, and we've heard that helps immensely as people prepare for their exam. So I highly recommend that. You can find it in the Google Play and the Apple App Store. Just search NASM Edge, and you'll be able to find that and utilize that as well.
There we go, Edge. So I'm a big fan of the app, and I think that it's nice to add your programming and to put your client's programming in that app, but to have a study component in there and just one upper, way to go. So, all right, Greg, just real quick, if there was anything else, I know I saw a question pop up and then disappear, so I don't want to tease anybody. If there's a question I can answer quickly, I'll try to get it done.
No, that was actually an accident. I just pressed a button on something I responded in the chat.
So gotcha.
That was an actual question. That was producer error. So I apologize.
Gotcha. All right. Very cool. Well, Greg, thank you so much for fielding these questions. And thanks for everybody who have joined in this Facebook Live that are asking questions. And again, I don't have the answers to everything, but I'll do the best I can to answer them. And maybe I'll do the best I can to answer them more concisely in the future. But I do hope that you found this helpful. I hope you found it beneficial. And then let us know in the comments also if this is something that you may want us to do again. And then we'll try to add in more sessions like this if you find this particular one helpful, where it's just a whole series of questions to be asked and answered live on the NASM Facebook live stream. And for those of you who are listening to the NASM podcast, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate it. And if you got questions, shoot me an email, or you can hit me up on Instagram. You can hit me at rick.richie, R-I-C-H-E-Y, at nasm.org. Or you can follow me on Instagram and ask questions in the messages there. So DM me at dr.rickritchie. Happy to answer questions and support you in whatever ways I can. Thank you so much. This has been the NASM CPT podcast.